We're different from the Empire because every life means something. Our soldiers aren't faceless stormtroopers, but our friends and lovers. Our dead were rebels, yes, and they were lady killers and jokers, and they struggled with their own demons. I intend to fight for victory not because it's enough. Here she paused, surveying the room, eyes skimming over her audience. But because it's the least we can do to honor the fallen. She smiled then, a small, sad, tight smile, and bowed her head, returning to the crowd. The company member's response was muted, but Namir heard soft affirmation, saw heads nod.
Onward to victory,
a man's voice muttered. Namir didn't see who spoke, but he thought it sounded like Hober. I didn't mean to upstage you, you know that. I just thought they needed to hear... Namir smiled bitterly and shook his head.
It's fine, he said.
He sat on the trunk in Hal's quarters, watching the governor as she perched at the edge of the bunk. You're probably right. A little inspiration is good for them. Next time, Chayla said. She took a swig from a bottle of brandy, not unlike the one she'd first brought aboard the Thunderstrike, and passed it to Namir. You get the next speech, even if I have to write it myself. Namir turned the bottle over in his hands and wondered where Chalice had found it. The influx of contraband after Ankuril could turn out to be a problem. He'd gone to the clubhouse after the funeral. He hadn't been unwelcome, and he'd stayed long enough to listen to a few stories, hear about Charmer's heroism on Tokut and the shore leave incident on Sigma Station. But conversations had a tendency to stop when he walked by. Bottles got hidden behind support beams. No, he thought. The problem wasn't that the troops were uncomfortable around him. The problem was that anything he said seemed trivial, like an abdication of responsibility for his part in the deaths. And he didn't have any speeches to give, any words of wisdom or solace for grieving friends. He could lead the squads of Twilight Company. He would try to lead them. But he had nothing to say to them when they mourned. He couldn't take part in the grieving when he was also the cause. So he'd come to Chalus, and she'd welcomed him. Next time, he agreed. We did well, though, she said. It'll be a while before we know what resources the Empire cannibalizes on Kuat to make up for Mardona, but that's my problem. You got them in and out alive. Mostly. I watched. The squads did the work. Welcome to command, Chayla said. She smirked and retrieved the bottle from Namir's hands, taking another quick swallow. Speaking of which, you should rest. You don't get time off between missions anymore. Namir grunted and rose from the trunk. Chayla mirrored him rising from the bed. She crossed the door before he could intercept and gestured to the bunk. Yours, she said. He started to argue and got a glower in return. I already moved my many possessions into Sergon's old quarters. It's past time you started staying here.
We could seal the door, Namir said. Make sure nobody gets the room.
Do you really want to bunk with your men? Chalice asked. Her tone made it clear what answer she expected. Do you really think they're better off with the commander in the next bed over? Namir watched Chalus a while. She seemed to be holding back a smile.
Get the hell out of my quarters, he said at last. And she laughed as she departed.
Chapter 27 Planet Zanast. 9 days into Operation Ringbreaker.
For the past 2 weeks, Vara hadn't felt much like SP-475 at all. The explosion on the rebel terrorist vessel had left her with a jagged scar across her forehead and a right ear that went deaf at intervals.
For the first few days after the incident, she'd suffered from headaches that left her pressing her forehead against cold metal floor panels at night and praying for unconsciousness. The medical droids assured her it was nothing unexpected and soon approved a return to light duty. Surveillance reviews, munitions maintenance, and the like. No one had visited her or wished her well. Her uncle might have done so under other circumstances, but he was still in holding, awaiting trial or release. On her first day back, as she cross-checked automated supply records with her own hand-counted inventory of blaster power packs, 113 joined her in the brightly lit armory. He'd led the team on the day of the explosion, interrogated the rebel agent himself. Somehow he'd survived too, even as close as he'd been to the detonation. Maybe, Thara thought, he really was one of the original clones. The commandos had been built to last. Other members of the team hadn't been so fortunate. She was glad she couldn't remember the sight of body parts blasted and strewn through the ship, but she could still imagine. "You're one of the new ones," 113 said. More a statement than a question. "Accelerated training to bulk out the core. Been young by your first assignment." "Yes, sir," Thara said. She was dressed in a variant of a cadet's uniform, in an open-faced helmet that left her every expression exposed. She felt blind without the glow of her old uniform's display. "Huh." SP-113 stared at her through his own helmet. Thara wondered if he was reviewing her record. "You survived. Give you credit for that. But you need to do better." "Better than leaving my comrades to die?" she wondered. It seemed a low threshold to clear.
"Yes, sir," Thara said.
"However long the med droid said to stay off patrol, cut it in half. We're short-handed. And the bosses want Nia Nunba and the rest of the cell found before they cause more trouble." The alien aboard the rebel ship had claimed the cell lacked supporters in Pinyumba, that the local civilians were too scared to help. No one believed it. Not Thara and her comrades, and certainly not her commanders. Still, Thara opened her mouth to protest.
"Sir,"
she asked. She shouldn't have been speaking, but she fumbled for the words anyway.
I thought...
"You thought what?"
"Hoth, sir. I thought the rebels would be less dangerous. Less active. Less something."
The garrison stormtroopers didn't gossip much, certainly not while on duty, when chatter was forbidden, and official policy discouraged bonding during off-hours. Troopers who grew attached to their comrades became inflexible, slow to adapt to new postings with new squads. Still, talk got around during meals or in the locker room, and Thara had heard about an attack on a prime rebel base in the Anoat sector. The enemy had been routed, the base obliterated. Darth Vader himself had led the troops to victory. The elite of the elite marching through fire and ice against 1,000 rebel traps. 113 made a short, scornful sound like a laugh as he turned away. "We're a long way from Hoth, and there are always more rebels." 1 week after her conversation with 113, Thara's full status was restored. She donned each piece of her uniform with care and diligence, reminding herself of her name and her mission and her duty to Sallust and the Empire. But the faint scratches on her armor and the dead silence in her right ear distracted her, and she fumbled as she locked her helmet into place. Nearly 30 stormtroopers stood at attention as the transport touched down onto the hangar floor. Another 30 were stationed out of sight or in the adjoining tunnels, ready for any surprise attack by the rebel cell. Still more teams were searching housing blocks in Pinyumba and locking down the Inusotor processing facility. Someone in charge decided that the transport's safe arrival was worth shutting down city business. SP-475 stood behind a maintenance crew, staring toward the tunnel through which the transport had descended from the surface. She imagined rebels deployed between dim rays of sunlight, prepping explosives in the shadows. The transport hissed, and her attention turned to the boarding ramp. Pinyumba officials rushed forward, meeting the first wave of arrivals and occluding her view. Half a dozen white armored figures surrounded the group and escorted them down a tunnel. Chatter played in her helmet. Team leaders reporting that nothing was amiss.
"Who are these guys?"
one of the maintenance workers asked. Now a second wave of arrivals marched down the boarding ramp. Black-clad officers, helmeted security personnel, and more stormtroopers. First 10, then 20, then more than SB-475 could count.
"Labor oversight," another worker replied. "Some rebels hit a supply depot on Mardona the other day. Need to make up production somewhere."
SB-475 hadn't heard that. She bristled at the idea that Pinyumba needed more troops, more overseers to do its part, but she forced the instinct down. 113 had told her that they were shorthanded, and they still hadn't found Nianunba. Maybe reinforcements weren't such a bad thing. Then she heard a high-pitched whine in her helmet. Her comrades began shouting. The overlapping, static-distorted voices were impossible to decipher. In a second, a commanding officer would override the others and make her orders clear. She wanted to freeze. She wanted to run. The last time she'd seen her fellow troops fall into chaos, men and women had died. Her chest ached. She wasn't breathing. In the periphery of her vision, she saw another trooper gesture behind her and up the cavern wall. Her rifle was in her hands as she turned. She stumbled half a step back and bumped into one of the maintenance crew. The helmet directed her attention to a mechanical sphere no larger than her fist, floating a dozen meters above the cavern floor and weaving toward the tunnel to the surface. She didn't question what it was. She brought up her rifle and squeezed the trigger 3 times. Her visor polarized against the red glare. 2 shots chipped the stone. The last clipped the sphere, sending it spiraling onto the ground and leaving a trail of sparks. Nothing exploded. No one died. It was a long time before she heard the comm chatter again, or noticed the 2 troopers kneeling over the fallen sphere.
"Spy cam,"
came a crisper voice.
"Knew the rebels couldn't stay away."
It was 113.
"Nice shot, 475.
SP-475 wanted to tear her helmet off and vomit. But she'd done her duty. She'd overcome her hesitation. Her shift was just beginning, and if the rebels were at work, she had to be ready. She had to push through.
Chapter 28. 15 light-years off the Rima trade route. 10 days into Operation Ringbreaker.
The dockyards of Najan Rovi fell in less than a day. The gas giant's floating habitats lacked a dedicated stormtrooper battalion, relying on Imperial fleet troopers and a complement of TIE fighters for defense. By the time the Thunderstrike had delivered its payload of Twilight Company strike teams, the dockyard's doom was sealed. By the time Twilight jumped to lightspeed and departed Najan Rovi, almost 100 Imperial luxury transports and light freighters were in flames. Executive shuttles for senior officers and special envoys of the ruling council, Chalice had explained during a briefing to the squad leaders. Stored and resupplied in Najan Rovi, but built by the Corellian Engineering Corporation. Once they're destroyed, Corellia will need to increase its production. The officers must have their toys. Increased production on Corellia meant shipbuilding resources and security transferred from Kuat. After Najan Rovi, Twilight Company was 1 step closer to its true objective, and the squad celebrated on their return from the dockyards. It was gratifying to see, though Namir was surprised that Chalice retreated to her quarters rather than accept congratulations in the dropship hangar. Thunderstrike's next destination was Obumubo, a frigid moon covered in a sea of icy liquid metal. There, Twilight was tasked with the obliteration of an Imperial garrison. There are certain people I want promoted out of Kuat, Chalice said at the senior staff's morning meeting. Once they're gone, they'll take the security with them. Kill the right man on Obu Mubo, and we create a job vacancy. Von Geis, one of the gentlest people Namir had ever known, asked if the target could be assassinated. Must we risk the whole company to destroy one man? Chalice said nothing at first, her lips twitching in an expression that never quite became a smile. Then she began coughing, spitting into her sleeve as her chest heaved. It was over a minute before she recovered enough to reply.
The Empire can't suspect our intentions, she said, her voice hoarse and her tone cold. The military employs very smart people who are doubtless wondering about our attacks. If the possibility of our striking Kuat crosses their minds, our entire operation ends. So yes, we risk the company.
Von Geis did not argue further. The attack on Obu Mubo was bloody. No Twilight soldier had died on the Janrovi, but injury and exhaustion had taken a toll. The garrison was smartly defended by experienced troops who'd held Obu Mubo's sea creatures at bay for months. The battlefield favored the defenders. Two Twilight infantry personnel and a medic drowned in silver waters while disembarking the dropships. A dozen more died in the first assault. It took 2 days of fighting before the company managed to erect its siege weapons on the fluid landscape. Cannon fire brought down the garrison at last, and the thunderstrike sped out of the system. Its dropship safely recovered as a phalanx of destroyers arrived. It was, Chalice promised, another victory. One step closer to Kuat. The night of the Thunderstrike's departure from Obu Mubo, after a late visit by Namir to M2-M5, Namir still loathed the engineering droid, but it was more amenable than most of the crew to delivering reports at odd hours. Namir heard a noise from the mess hall and made his way to investigate. He found a dozen soldiers gathered around a portable holoprojector on one of the dining tables. The projector was running an Imperial newscast. The digitized image of an attractive young woman proudly announced a string of Imperial triumphs over rebels in the Outer Rim.
Since the destruction of the Alliance base, over 15 rebel outposts and 7 members of the enemy leadership have surrendered. Emperor Palpatine is reportedly considering public trials for select combatants in the hope that others, witnessing their fair treatment, will follow their example and turn themselves in.
Is any of it true?
Namir recognized the voice and saw Roach seated at the corner of the table. He shook his head.
I don't know, he admitted.
It's propaganda, so it's not all true, but... He sighed, uncertain how much to share. We still haven't made contact with High Command. The fleet's out there. Condition unknown. Was he being too direct? Too oblique? He barely remembered what it was like speaking to his colleagues without second-guessing himself. Roach nodded briskly. The others were either watching the newscast or avoiding his gaze. He wanted to leave, but he was their commander. He owed them something better. Let's just make sure that when the fleet comes back, we've given the Alliance an edge. It was the best he could come up with, and he couldn't tell if the stern nods and raised fists he got in response were genuine signs of enthusiasm or concessions to a commander's authority. Maybe it was best not to know. Mediu was among the first casualties on Nakadia. Namir stayed by her side in the medical tent as she sweated and bled, thrashed and stank. Bright, blotchy rashes covered her face, and she insisted Namir was her mother. Didn't remember his name when he told her he wasn't. Eventually, he gave up on the truth and stroked her hair as her organs slowly liquefied. He left her alone only twice, both times to empty his stomach and wipe the bile from his lips. Namir had known Nakadia would be difficult. He hadn't expected the deaths there to be so horrible. The planet was an agricultural world of boundless hills and neck-high stalks of stiff, leafy flora. Twilight had come to devastate Nakadia's plastoid factories, where millions of tons of farm crops were processed into armor-grade polymers and synthetic resins. Namir hadn't realized such conversions were possible. He couldn't imagine how plants could be transmuted into industrial materials, but no one else seemed surprised, and he kept his questions to himself. Looking stupid in front of his colleagues wouldn't inspire confidence. He'd left Governor Chalice behind on the Thunderstrike and joined the squads in the initial wave of assaults. They struck covertly under cover of night, advancing and retreating invisibly through the forests of stalks. It was a good strategy, but it was grueling for troops who'd barely had time to rest since Obumubo. It required men and women with barely treated injuries to march sleepless through difficult terrain. And then, Mediu and the others had returned from a sortie, staggering and bloody-eyed. The medics had recognized what was happening, but they didn't confirm Namir's suspicions until after Mediu was dead. "These aren't pesticides. They've got military bioweapons," Namir told the squad leaders that morning. He kept his voice calm despite the boiling fury in his guts. "Be careful." 16 other soldiers fell to airspeeders spraying toxins before a scout team located their point of origin. Gadrin, Mizoon, and a dozen other alien soldiers accompanied Namir, who'd wrapped himself in as much protective gear as he'd been able to scrounge, to a launch pad and warehouse high in the hills. They burned the warehouse to the ground, watched metal blacken and curl, and listened to poison sizzle inside. Twilight Company 1, Nakadia 2. When Namir returned to the Thunderstrike, he marched directly to Chalice's quarters, not stopping to remove his armor or stow his rifle. He knocked on the door and didn't wait for a reply before keying it open. If it hadn't been unlocked, he might have blasted the control panel. "It was the same toxin!" he snarled. Chalice sat on her bunk, sketching something on a datapad. She made a few strokes across the screen, considered her work, and set the device down before looking up at Namir. "Give me context," she said. Her voice was calm, but her eyes were hard. "You're talking about the bioweapons on Nakadia?" "I heard the bioweapons," Namir said, "that came from Coyurity. We destroyed the distillery. We destroyed the stockpiles. That stuff should be gone, and instead my people are dead." "Sit down," Chayla said. Namir made no motion to do so, and she shrugged. "I'm sorry for your losses."
"You aren't."
She shrugged again.
"I'm not in favor of them. Are you going to listen, Sergeant? Our next planetfall is in 3 days. So if you're just going to vent, I'll get back to my work."
"Talk."
She closed her eyes and pressed her forefinger to one of her temples as if massaging a headache. She spoke slowly, cautiously, apparently constructing an argument as she went. "You're a fine commander. You're a good judge of what your people need and what they can accomplish. But you still think like a man from Crucible."
"Meaning?"
"Meaning you don't understand the scale of the enemy. It took me longer than it should have to. I don't fault you for it."
Namir's ire had drained from him. The strap of his rifle felt too heavy around his neck. His bitterness remained, however, and every word Chalice spoke grated.
"We, you and your squad, destroyed enough biotoxin to save millions, maybe more. But the Empire has been building its arsenal for decades. How much do you think is stored in dusty armories and warehouses across the galaxy? If I'd known there was any present on Nacadia, I might have chosen a different target. I didn't. We'll be better prepared next time.
How many more next times should we prepare for?
Chalice rose slowly from the bunk and met Namir's gaze. He saw her chest heave as she suppressed a cough.
You've seen the plan, she said. It won't be long until Kuat.
I really hope not, Namir said.
I think Hober's tired of conducting funerals.
Namir found a speech had been added to his datapad an hour before the ceremony in the vehicle bay. It talked about how Twilight Company would honor the squad's sacrifices, about how Nacadia was a reminder of the depth the Empire would sink to, about how on a world that could have fed trillions, the enemy had chosen to deploy poison. He didn't read the speech at the funeral. Instead, after Hover wrapped up the usual proceedings and Namir did nothing, Chayla strode to the fore and recited it herself. The reaction seemed largely positive, which didn't especially surprise Namir. It was a good speech. The governor was winning the company over one day at a time, and the troops were getting used to her proclamations. He visited neither the clubhouse nor Chalice that night. Instead, he laid in his bunk, Howell's bunk, wondering what the captain would have done differently. Whether the captain would have done anything differently, or whether Twilight was the same as it had always been, bleeding, fighting, desperate to win but losing just as often. And it was just Namir's perspective that had changed. He regretted arguing with Chalice, and it troubled him to think that she was, in fact, the only person on the ship who understood his position. The thought of telling her as much flitted across his brain before he swatted it away. Chalice was not his friend, and whatever warmth there had been between them had frozen over on Hoth. The thought, too, seemed off somehow, but it was close enough to the truth. Over the following week, Twilight Company fought two more battles, in the mountains of Nator and the miasmic canyons of Zagabah. The company won. Soldiers died. The grueling pace continued, and even Chalice agreed that a day spent resting and resupplying was in order. Chalice and Von Geis proposed that the Thunderstrike would put in overnight at Heap 9, a junker world beneath the notice of the Empire, where scavengers picked at the garbage piles of a long-dead civilization. As shore leave went, it wasn't much. Namir anticipated that much of the company would choose to remain aboard the ship. But he nonetheless found himself in an open-air cantina with a handful of his colleagues drinking noxious local brew and trying to flirt with a green-skinned woman who seemed unimpressed by his lies about life as a meteor miner. Gadrin found him three drinks after the woman had left.
You made a fine effort, but now is the time to acknowledge defeat and regather your dignity.
Namir tried to straighten in his seat and discovered he was still slouching forward. I'm betting you didn't tell that to Brand. Gadrin cast a glance toward the far end of the cantina. Namir hadn't seen Brand for a good hour.
That is because she is better at this than you. And no one is troubled if she looks the fool.
Namir barked a laugh and pushed his drink away. Subtle. Fine. Howl never sat around looking like an idiot.
In public,
Gadrin said, his tone patient and conciliatory. He slipped an arm under Namir's shoulder, pulling him to his feet.
What Howl did in private is another secret he will take with him. But I have no doubt he was as flawed and foolish as the rest of us.
Namir grunted. Gadrin left an arm around him, half supporting Namir as they walked together along the main street of the settlement, a dirt road flanked on both sides by junk shops and scrap traders, and ignored the shouts of hawkers and thieves.
You remember the fighting on Dravis?
Namir asked.
The way we celebrated after?
Gadrin made a hollow sound of amusement.
I remember. You made an impression on the fire dancers.
He paused, scratched at his waddle with one hand.
Twitch brought up Dravis the other night. We miss you at the clubhouse.
Namir didn't answer. Gadrin kept talking.
There is another campaign that has been recurring in my memories. This one was before your time. Before Bran's. Before even Lieutenant Sergon joined us. Have I spoken of the Rock Pax?
Namir thought about nodding, making his excuses, and slipping away. He enjoyed Gadrin's company, but he wasn't sure how long he could bear it. Still, there was nowhere to go. The dropships wouldn't return to the Thunderstrike for hours yet. I don't think so, Namir said. Gadrin nodded sagely.
I was new to the company, barely able to hold the blaster without singeing my fingers.
He wiggled meaty digits, as if inspecting them for scars.
We were barely 200 strong, and we marched for days through the ruins of a proto-species kingdom in an effort to flank our foe. Had we taken to the skies, our attempts at stealth would have been futile. But we left behind a trail of soldiers who could no longer walk, or whose hunger ravaged their bodies as our supplies dwindled. We lost brave men to dreadful beasts. Others vanished, consumed by alien technology we lacked the knowledge to defend against. Then came the battle. We won that day, against the laughing menace and her fiendish warriors, and we extracted the rebels we had been sent to save. But only 37 Twilight soldiers survived the clash.
Rough, even by Twilight standards, Namir thought. Which would be why I haven't heard the story before. He said, there aren't many left to tell it. Not exactly uplifting.
No, it is not. But it is etched in the history of our company, Howl's company. He led those 200 to their deaths, and he led those who lived in the aftermath. He rebuilt the company from the ashes of its sacrifice.
Namir straightened and looked into Gadrin's alien eyes. He smiled, but he heard a challenge in his voice. And you think, what? I'm leading the company into another massacre?
No. I think you fear the sacrifices we have made, and the sacrifices to come. Howl felt the death of his men as keenly as any of us, but he never grew hard or distant. I told you at his funeral that I cannot explain him, yet I know he believed sacrifice was the strength of Twilight. And he wielded that strength to good purpose.
If I were afraid of sacrifice, Namir said, I never would have agreed to Chalice's plan in the first place.
As you like, but we follow you, not Chalice. And we will gladly give you what you need to reach the shipyards of Kuat.
After the respite of Heap 9, came the asteroid mines of the Kuliquo Belt. Namir planned the attack personally, selecting the 20 soldiers he trusted most to sabotage machinery in an airless, lightless death trap. At Gadrin's urging, he agreed to send Roach. She returned from the mines with a hunk of gold the size of her fist and presented it to Namir as a gift. He placed it on the desk in his quarters and later toyed with it in both hands as Chalice briefed him on the situation at Kuat. She'd been recording Imperial comm traffic, decrypting low-priority signals in the evenings, and she seemed pleased with the results of Twilight's actions. The 107th Stormtrooper Legion specializes in putting down slave revolts and worker uprisings. Three full battalions have now been pulled from stable, predictable Kuat and reassigned elsewhere, thanks to us. And, she added swiftly, raising a finger, thanks to the reliable idiocy of so many old friends on the Imperial Ruling Council. Reliable idiocy? Namir echoed. It wasn't long ago that you were desperately worried about our plan being discovered.
By intelligence analysts, absolutely. But by the people I worked with for a decade and who decided I wasn't a threat after I left? No. I'm really not concerned with what they think now.
There was no lightness in her tone, no attempt at charm. There rarely was when she and Namir were alone. So what's next? If we hit many more targets, we'll be in no shape to take on the shipyards, no matter how weak they are.
Two more stops, Chayla said, though resistance will be heavy. We're moving toward the heart of Imperial space.
If half the enemy weren't still chasing Alliance High Command, we couldn't even get close. As it is, we need to hit fast enough and hard enough that the Empire can't surround us.
Two more, Namir repeated. He rolled it around in his head as if the number meant something real, as if opposition and battleground and days in combat versus days in motion didn't matter at all. I can give you two more.
Good, Chayla said, because this opportunity disappears as soon as the Empire regroups.
We take Sallust next, then Malastare. When those are done, Kuat falls.
Victory is in sight, Sergeant. We just need to reach for it.
Sallust was a mining and manufacturing center for the Empire. A once proud and influential member of the Republic that had been reduced to the position of a scrabbling vassal. A source of fuel for the Imperial machine and little more. Its cities were buried like gemstones below the scorched and blasted surface, housing billions of native Sallustans and generations of immigrants from off-world. Seated alone in the Thunderstrike's mess hall, Namir listened to talk about the coming battle. Zab, of all people, spoke the Sallustan native tongue. Holber had heard rumors of movements to resist the Empire emerging on the planet over the years, quashed by the Imperials every time they began to blossom. Namir knew only what he was told and what he read in the Thunderstrike's spotty computer records. He'd never seen a Sallustan before, or maybe he had and just didn't realize it. The day before the Thunderstrike was scheduled to arrive at Sallust, he made another effort to contact Alliance High Command. The farther Twilight Company encroached into Imperial territory, the more difficult it would be to open a secure channel. This was, so far as Namir was concerned, the last opportunity to find another path forward. After this, the company was truly committed. No, he thought, as he toyed with Roach's gold in his quarters and stared down at his terminal. That was what he could tell Chalice, but it wasn't the truth. This wasn't the last opportunity for Twilight. It was simply the last opportunity for him to sidestep his promise. If you can't get behind what they believe in, maybe it's time to walk away. He decided to give Twilight what it wanted, a fighting chance against the Empire's evil. Only the rebellion could relieve him of that responsibility now. After 2 hours of waiting, the Thunderstrike received a reply from a rebel relay station. When the hologram flickered into existence at Namir's desk, he frowned at the woman who appeared in the image, trying to remember where he'd seen her face before.
Careful what you say, Thunderstrike, the woman said, and make it fast. This channel may not be secure.
Hoth. Namir had met her on Hoth. He'd argued with her in Krindle. She'd punched him in the jaw. He wanted to laugh, but he suppressed it and merely smiled instead. He wondered if she recognized him.
Understood, he said. We may be out of contact a while and we haven't received new orders. Anything we should know?
Final orders still stand. High Command has not regrouped. Vader is still leading the hunt.
She scowled a moment, seemed to consider how to phrase her next thought.
Do you still have your cargo?
Namir cocked his head before the meaning hit him. Apparently she recognized him after all.
Safely aboard, he said.
Why do you ask?
The woman paused again. The hologram flickered. Namir wondered if the communication had been cut off, but then she spoke, voice distorted by static.
No reason. General Vigar had high hopes, was all.
The general who'd welcomed Namir and Chalice to Echo Base. The man who'd kept Namir's discipline problem from Howl.
But Vigar's dead now. So is the old plan. You're on your own, Thunderstrike.
Aren't we all? Namir asked. And the hologram abruptly flickered out.
The Thunderstrike and a Pylon's Promise jumped out of hyperspace less than 500,000 kilometers from Sullust. So close that upon the vessel's entry into real space, the sudden clench of the planet's gravity nearly tore both ships apart. Namir lurched forward in his seat restraints in one of the Thunderstrike's dropships and heard metal pop in the hangar bay. Emergency klaxons blared. An instant later, the voice of Commander Tona came over the comm, roaring laughter and triumph. Sallust's orbital defenses were too formidable to risk facing in a straight-up fight. That was the only thing Twilight senior staff had managed to agree on. Tona's solution: jump in barely a stone's throw from the planet, deliver the dropships, and jump out before the defenders could coordinate a counterattack, had possessed the potential to obliterate the company in a nanosecond if the jump were miscalculated. But Namir hadn't heard any better alternatives and approved the plan anyway. There were many fates worse than a quick and foolish death. The other downside to Tona's approach was that it left no time for a first wave of ground teams to clear a beachhead. The dropships would descend together, and Namir and Chalice and the medics and engineers would arrive alongside the company vanguard. Word was that Hober had sent armor and fatigues to Chalice's quarters with a note reading, "Not available in black." Namir had no complaints. He'd assigned Chalice to a separate dropship, better to spread the risk, and he felt almost comfortable sandwiched between his colleagues' armored bodies, their rifles clacking together as the ship's thrusters discharged and its occupants swayed. This was Planetfall in all its dangerous, sweaty, nauseating glory, as he'd experienced 100 times before. He had to fight to avoid blacking out as they struck Sullust's atmosphere. He didn't know whether he succeeded in staying conscious throughout the flight. All he was sure of was that the dropship eventually slowed and the thunder of its engines quieted. He was the last man onto the surface, dropping 2 meters from the bay doors onto a slab of cracked and yellow-stained obsidian. A cloud of ochre motes rose where his boots impacted, and he tasted ash through the filter of his breath mask. The dropship soared back into the blue-gray sky, pursued by dark specks. Other dropships or enemy aircraft, Namir wasn't sure. He surveyed his surroundings and saw that he stood on a narrow shelf jutting from a massive black slope. The shelf faded into the distance on either side, apparently wrapping around the mountainside. Below him, shallow crevices led down the slope like riverbeds to distant metal structures embedded in the base of the mountain. Bunkers and transport stations, he thought. Secondary targets and potential threats. Above Namir, the slope rose and became increasingly sheer toward the mountain's apex. Gripping the peak of the mountain was another metal structure, a compound of spires and support frames like a parasite feasting on the mountain's skull. Comm signals cut through static, announcing another squad's safe arrival. Namir waved the other soldiers from his dropship to gather as they finished scanning the perimeter. We've got 24 hours before pickup. Don't plan on eating, sleeping, or emptying your bladders. We're in hostile territory, and I need you ready to work. Someone shouted, "Yes, Captain!" And Namir winced. Were they all calling him that now? He bent down, scooped up a shard of obsidian, and tossed it overhand down the slope. Down there!
Buried underneath the enemy camps is a Celestin city. If you end up there, turn around and start climbing. You won't need maps for this mission. Up top, he continued, and turned to look toward the peak, is the Inyusu Tor Mineral Processing Facility. That's where the Empire burrows into this mountain and extracts ore from the magma inside. This facility supplies almost 10% of the raw manufacturing resources for the planet. So it's big. It's important. It's our target.
He looked around and saw heads nodding. In the distance, around the shelf, other squads were approaching. He cinched his rifle strap and smiled like a soldier ready to die for an idiot commander.
Let's go get it, he said.
Even unprepared for an attack and only lightly guarded, the processing facility should have been unassailable by infantry. Ground forces would need to trek up the unforgiving rock while enduring a barrage of blaster fire from above. Move too swiftly and the squads were sure to be slaughtered. Move too slowly and the Empire would have time to scramble air support. Upon reaching the apex, the teams would need to force their way inside the facility itself. Breaching a wall would be too time-consuming with the tools Twilight had available. The facility was built to withstand volcanic heat, which left only the main entrances. These would be protected by the entirety of the facility's security force. At best, Twilight Company could expect a standoff until additional Imperial units arrived from below the mountain. Nonetheless, Namir sent all but four squads, a team of engineers, a rearguard selection of scouts and sentries, and a handful of medics to attempt the assault. He observed with Chalice from a mobile camp less than 50 meters downslope from the fighting. It was a place the injured could retreat to and a command hub for senior staff out of the fray. It was not a site for squads to withdraw to when hard-pressed. Twice, Namir had the grim task of informing squads that there could be no withdrawal. He watched the crimson flash of blaster fire sizzle in volleys against mountain obsidian, saw his colleagues desperately taking cover behind stones smaller than speeder bikes. He lifted his macro binoculars high and saw stormtroopers and fleet troopers lined neatly before the processing facility walls, ready to move to shelter the moment the rebels closed in. As the squads climbed upward, 10, 20 meters over the course of an hour, the camp moved with them. The scouts reported Imperial airspeeders rising from the garrisons below, and Namir sent word down the chain of command, "Advance, get closer." If the squads were near enough to the apex, the airspeeder pilots would be reluctant to drop sweep bombs for fear of damaging the processing facility. That wouldn't save the squads from the speeder's blaster cannons, but with luck, cannon fire could be evaded. The teams climbed the mountain. The enemy began to withdraw to the facility entrances. As the airspeeders flitted into view, Namir, crouched as low to the ground as he could manage, signaled to one of the medics. "Get me the Plex," he called. Chalice watched him from her position flat on the ground. She said nothing. Maybe she didn't understand what he was doing, or she knew he needed a distraction to maintain his sanity. Maybe she didn't care. The PLX-1 was a cumbersome weapon, bulky and weighty and half as tall as a man. The control labels had long since worn off the Plex that Namir accepted from the medic. Namir imagined it as the sole survivor of Twilight's earliest incarnation, when Howl and a handful of others had first been tasked by the Rebellion. He didn't need the labels to adjust the settings to confirm its payload. With the Plex hoisted on one shoulder, Namir rose to his feet and marched down the slope away from the camp. He heard the shouts of his soldiers over the comm and tuned them out, kept his head turned away from the flickers of crimson. As he lifted his weapons barreled toward the gray sky, he smiled as he was briefly left alone in the world. An airspeeder soared into view. As Namir had predicted, it veered toward him. He was an obvious target. The lone man standing in view on the mountain slope. He turned toward it,
pulled the trigger on the Plex and felt his shoulder snap back as a rocket roared into the air, reeking of exhaust and accelerant. The airspeeder tried to swerve, firing its cannons as it did so. Shards of stone stung Namir when blaster bolts impacted nearby. Then the speeder was gone, consumed in a ball of flame and black smoke. Namir drew a breath, turned back up the slope, and tapped his comm. "Where do we stand?" he asked.
"Ready for phase two,"
Chayla said. Namir couldn't feel the mountain shake beneath him when the tunneling crew entered the processing facility. Intellectually, he knew it wasn't possible, but he thought he felt a tremor in his soles anyway when the designated moment arrived, and he clenched a fist in triumph. While the bulk of the company had been climbing toward the apex, four squads and a team of engineers had descended to the transport stations embedded in the mountain's base. There, they'd stolen a pair of mining vehicles and proceeded to burrow their own way beneath the slope, up the mountain, and into the facility. Later, the burrowing squads would talk of tearing their way through an underground wall and terrifying the Celestine workers. At the appointed time, Namir ordered the above-ground squads to press forward, and shocked Imperial security teams and stormtroopers found themselves trapped between enemies both inside and outside the facility. Once again, Twilight Company won. It had been Chalice's plan, and Namir had doubted it. Doubted that the mining vehicles would be stored where she claimed. Doubted the machines could burrow their way up the mountain fast enough to win the battle. But Chalice had had faith in the systems of the Empire and the reliability of its quartermasters. She'd been able to access Imperial stock records and provide Twilight's engineers with vehicle schematics. "You were right," Namir said. They stood together in the security office, looking down through the window at the workers marching out of the facility toward the industrial lifts and tramways that led down the mountainside. Twilight soldiers kept the Celestines moving at gunpoint. Chalice nodded. Her chest heaved as she suppressed a cough. Namir wondered how she was handling the air supply. The facility filtered the atmosphere, making the breath masks unnecessary indoors. But the smell was still sulfurous and foul. When the last of the workers were gone, the transports were disabled and the squads finished scouring for any remaining resistance. Then the engineers began their second task of the day, programming the magma extractors to flood the facility interior. The new program would be run after the dropships arrived to exfiltrate Twilight at the last possible minute. The facility would be utterly annihilated as the Thunderstrike fled back into deep space, and the Empire would be deprived of one of Sallust's most valuable resources. Until then, Twilight soldiers had roughly 12 hours to pass. Namir assigned patrols both in and out of the facility. He kept a comm channel open and listened to Sentry's report. With perfect regularity, every 30 minutes, Imperial airspeeders passing overhead. He wasn't overly concerned. The Empire had no interest in destroying its own investment, and it didn't know what Twilight was planning. Late at night or very early in the morning, he paced across one of the walkways overlooking an exposed magma stream. The flow smelled noxious even through the shimmering heat shield and cast everything in a lurid red glow. When Namir noticed that Brand had arrived at his side, her skin looked like polished bronze.
"Final numbers?" she asked.
4 dead, 16 injured," he said. "We were lucky." Brand nodded and wrinkled her nose. Namir wanted to laugh at her suppressed, too dignified reaction to the odor.
"Anyone you knew well?"
she asked. "Not too well," Namir said. Names and faces he recognized. Men and women and aliens he'd sat with in the mess or trained as fresh meat. They were all Twilight, all family. But none like Nadeu or Charmer or Rojo or Beak or even Ajax, or the comtech he'd pledged to forget on the surface. Today's losses were ones he could pretend didn't matter. People whose ghosts wouldn't haunt him aboard the Thunderstrike. He drifted to the railing of the walkway, tried to stare down into the magma, and failed to look long at the flow's bright surface. Brand followed him.
Yeah,
she said. He couldn't tell what she was agreeing with. They stood together that way a while. Namir thought of all the hours he'd spent silent and alone with Chalice on Mardona 3, on the shuttle from Hoth, and was quietly amazed that two people, both utterly motionless, could be present in such different ways. Brand became one with her surroundings, like a boulder on a mountainside. Chalice was like a nail in a pane of cracked glass, solid as steel, but in fundamental tension with the world around her.
Why are we doing this?
Brand asked. Namir frowned.
Chalus says, not Sallust. The whole campaign. Kuat.
Right.
This.
I made a promise, he said, to support Twilight Company and the Rebellion. Everyone here, everyone but me and Chalus, joined to strike back at the Empire. I'm giving them the best way I know to do it.
Huh,
Brand said. In an instant, Brand's reserve seemed to turn aggressive. The silence that had been comforting now irked Namir.
What?
He asked.
Say it.
She shrugged.
I'm just thinking. You ever ask Howl why he did something? I really don't need you comparing me to Howl right now.
She kept speaking as if he hadn't replied.
He never gave you one answer.
That's because he never did anything for one reason. Never did anything that wouldn't count as a victory, even in a military defeat. Not to his mind, anyway. Maybe. She shrugged again.
The point is, if all we're doing is spitting in the face of evil, hitting back just to hit back, maybe Gadrin and Roach see some proud warrior sacrifice garbage in that, but you and me are too old for it.
He straightened up, stared at her. She met his gaze, face unreadable as ever. And all he could think of was, how dare you? How dare she question him now, weeks after on Kuril, instead of earlier, when it would have mattered? He wanted to say something that would sting, something that would hurt her. It would be only just. He knew her secrets. But when he found his ammunition, he let it sink back into the ocean of his mind. Instead, he said, "Do you have anything useful for me? Or are you just questioning my ability to command?"
"Neither,"
Brand said, and walked away. Namir swore silently into the fire. The Thunderstrike was scheduled to arrive around midday. By early morning, Twilight soldiers had packed any gear worth salvaging from the facility. The engineers had programmed the extractors to flood the compound with magma at the flip of a switch. Namir had sent alternative dropship assignments and locations to the squads in case the Empire's air support made pickup at the facility impossible. Namir was squatting just outside the main entrance, watching the skies through macro binoculars and wondering about Twilight's next mission. The strike on Malastare. The last strike before Kuat, when he received a signal from Thunderstrike indicating it had arrived in orbit.
"We've got heavy TIE presence,"
Commander Tona said.
"We're going to come in low. Use our own firepower to cover the dropships while the Promise and her X-Wings watch our flank. Should be a good show."
Namir waved at a sentry and a slow stream of Twilight squads began hustling out of the facility. An engineer cast him a questioning glance and he shook his head.
"Not yet," he called. "Wait for the dropships."
No point in being hasty. He waited for the shadow of the Thunderstrike to cross the clouds and listen to Tona's updates. A dozen TIE fighters destroyed, a dozen more incoming. 3 minutes until he released the dropships. 2 minutes. A dark shape took form high above,
and the macro binoculars enhanced its edges until it looked like a starship.
1 minute, Tona said. Get ready to board. We're cutting it close.
Then a dozen new specks flitted into Namir's view, and Tona began cursing. Far above came a sound like thunder. Namir couldn't see what was happening at first. He demanded an update from Tona, but the commander either wasn't listening or could no longer hear him. Yet the form of the thunderstrike among the clouds continued to grow, continued to descend, now sporting a red and green halo as blaster cannons and turbo lasers ignited the air. The soldiers nearby watched uneasily, murmured questions that Namir couldn't answer. He winced as a burst of static pierced his ear, started to adjust his link before a new voice cut in.
Twilight, this is the Promise,
a woman's voice said.
We've been ambushed. Whole blasted swarm came in from behind the moon. They were waiting for the thunderstrike to hit Atmos.
Namir swore too loudly. A dozen heads turned to look at him. The thunderstrike seemed to be descending faster. Pull back, he said into his link. He sounded calmer than he felt.
We can hold out here. Pull back now.
But the order came too late. The Thunderstrike was no longer lowering itself by thrusters and repulsors. Its prow had tipped forward and it trailed black fog. Fire swallowed its hull, brighter than the gleam of blasters. Every soldier in Twilight Company stood at the entrance to the facility and turned to watch the troop transport spiral through the air. It leveled itself briefly, then dipped again, until its roar was constant like the crash of ocean waves. Then it passed out of sight around the curve of the mountain and the ground rumbled. The word retreat came in over the comm, the woman's voice repeating over and over until a burst of static ended the transmission. The Thunderstrike was down. The Promise and her starfighters were gone, if not destroyed. Twilight Company was trapped on Sallust.
Chapter 29. Planet Sallust. 31 days into Operation Ringbreaker.
Stormtroopers must remain in uniform at all times while in view of the public. It was a simple rule, a basic rule, drilled into every cadet's brain until it became instinct. Thara Nyendi believed in it, knew it was integral to maintaining the public trust. A stormtrooper without a helmet was an individual with her own name and needs and goals. You couldn't trust individuals. A stormtrooper in uniform represented the Empire. That meant something. None of which explained why she'd removed her helmet in the security office of Pinyumba Transport Station 4. It was unlikely she'd been seen, but it was still possible. The black visor stared up at her from the console while she chewed on her ration bar. When her armor's memory was downloaded, she'd probably be caught, her indiscretion flagged, and automatically appended to her record. She was just so tired. Was a 5-minute break and an early lunch too much to ask? For the past 3 weeks, she'd worked 10-hour shifts daily. She'd received no further treatment nor counseling after the horror she'd experienced aboard the rebel terrorist vessel. Her hearing still came and went in her right ear. She knew other troopers in other worlds had been through far worse, and she didn't complain. Still, she flinched whenever she opened the door to an apartment pod to search for rebel supporters. But if the hunt for the rebels had been the only burden, she could have suffered through it. Since the raid on the warehouse world, the Empire had been demanding longer shifts from the civilian workers as well. This in turn meant more overseers and security teams to enforce standards. New transports arrived almost daily from off-world, while other enforcers were hired locally and rapidly trained. The entire city was tired, and Thara had nowhere to turn for respite. The rebellion was to blame for this as well.
The raids were continuing across nearby sectors, and Sallust had to make up the difference where it could. She visited her uncle's cantina one night. She'd been discreet. She only wanted to see how it was functioning in his absence, while he was still awaiting trial or release from the holding pens.
If Cobalt Front hadn't decided to bomb factories instead of write letters to the governor, one of the old men had said, maybe we'd have someone to speak up.
Cobalt Front never cared about workers' rights, another had argued. The rebellion was behind it from the start. It doesn't matter now, said a third, a man with bandages wrapped around his steam-burnt eyes. Blame doesn't matter. Pray the storm passes, and that the harvest is richer after the rain. But the storm hadn't passed. Instead, the rebellion had sent an army to Sallust. Vara hadn't fought during the invasion. She hadn't been at the processing facility or the surface garrisons. And when they'd sent her on patrol at night, assigned to a stormtrooper squad full of off-world veterans who could recognize a blaster's specifications by the sound of its trigger, she'd trembled every time she saw a distant figure on the mountain. She'd nearly shot at a speeder bike piloted by an Allied scout. Only her sergeant's angry, snapped order had stopped her. She was willing to fight. She'd go to the facility if she was ordered, shoot at rebels and avenge the colleague she'd already lost. And she was willing to follow the protocols delivered to her at the morning briefing. Instructions for a crackdown in the city, should the citizens of Pinyumba or rebel infiltrators take the opportunity to strike. Door-to-door searches, roundups of subversives and suspected subversives, lockdowns of all housing blocks and workplaces. She knew her duty. She hoped drastic measures wouldn't be necessary, and she was prepared to enact them if they were. But after so many weeks of hunting and seeking and waiting for the next bomb to go off, so many 10-hour shifts that ended with her face down on a coarse pillow and crying, she needed a moment, just a moment, for herself. So she chewed her ration bar slowly and tried not to meet the gaze of the helmet balanced on the security console before her. She hadn't quite finished eating when her comlink blared an emergency signal. She threw the bar and wrapper to the floor, scooped her helmet up and donned it as data cascaded onto the display. There was an emergency on the surface. Stormtrooper teams were being deployed to the streets of Pinyumba and the upper garrisons. All units were expected to be combat ready. She felt a wave of guilt for neglecting her duty and pushed it aside. She was SP-475 of the Imperial 97th Stormtrooper Legion, and she'd been ordered to report to the transport station's upper levels. Were the rebels coming down from the mountain? She wondered. Was the city going to be attacked? 20 other troopers crowded into the cargo lift as it rose to the surface. When she stepped off metal and onto rock, her display flickered as it updated to accommodate the outdoor lighting. She heard wind, and behind the wind, a shrieking, rumbling sound. Behind the rumbling was the sound of blasters, distant and tinny. Her fellow soldiers were looking up, pointing at something in the sky. As she scrambled to her post, she saw a ship plummeting toward the mountain, wrapped in black smoke and fire. It was enormous. It was a rebel vessel. It had to be. When it struck the side of the mountain, the crash sounded like the explosion she'd survived in the spaceport. This time, she was sure all of Pinyumba would suffer.
Part 4. Siege. Chapter 30.
Brema Sector Outskirts. 2 days before the siege of Inusutur.
Captain Tabor Saitaron was pleased. He'd forgotten the difference having a plan made. Intellectually, of course, he'd always understood the value, had lectured to his students about the importance of purpose to a ship's morale.
Yet in his weeks aboard the Herald, he discounted the fact that he too was part of the Star Destroyer's crew. When his men looked at Prelate Verge askance and feared for their future, Tabor shared in the toll.